Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, the podcast channel in the New Books Network that features interviews with philosophers about their new ideas as expressed in their newly published books. I'm Carrie Figdor, and I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese. Today's podcast features a book about disgusting art, that is, art that deliberately aims to cause disgust. Aesthetic judgments regarding the value, or not, of artworks have historically been tied to the notion of beauty. What is valuable in art is what is in some sense beautiful. But much great art is not beautiful or even pleasurable to experience. In fact, it may specifically aim to cause responses that are anything but feelings of pleasure or experiences of beauty. A really good horror movie is one that frightens us out of our wits, and a really good murder mystery is one that is puzzling to the very end. Tragedies are supposed to make us feel pity and sorrow, and when they don't, they are aesthetic failures. So there are plenty of works of art and genres of art that succeed only when they cause non-pleasurable responses. The aesthetic value of these kinds of art raises a couple of philosophical puzzles. One is the paradox of fiction. How is it that things that we know are not real can cause emotional responses as if they were real? Why do we experience the adrenaline rush and the racing pulse of fear when we know very well that Hannibal Lecter is just a character on the screen? One famous response to this puzzle is the claim that we don't really feel fear at all, just something that is like real fear in some ways. Of course, this sort of answer presupposes a definition of real fear. You don't get to say that our response to a horror film isn't real fear unless you have a theory of fear, or even better, of the emotions quite generally. And a second puzzle is the paradox of aversion. How can an aversive experience be aesthetically valuable? How can something that repels also be aesthetically attractive? These paradoxes arise in spades when it comes to the emotion of disgust. Disgust is characterized by nausea, queasiness, and a general feeling of discomfort, of, well, disgust. Crawling maggots are disgusting, rotting flesh is disgusting, the eating of human flesh is disgusting. Moreover, the physiological responses we have to disgusting things are automatic, like our fear responses. So the paradoxes of fiction and aversion are acute when it comes to art that aims to cause disgust by using disgusting images, and it's mostly images rather than tastes or smells, as a means to a kind of aesthetic experience, an experience that might be called, appropriately enough, aesthetic disgust. Today's podcast is an interview with Carolyn Korsmeyer, professor of philosophy at the University at Buffalo, State University of New York. Professor Korsmeyer's new book is Savoring Disgust, The Foul and the Fair in Aesthetics, from Oxford. In her book, and in our interview, Professor Korsmeyer discusses the nature of disgust as an emotion, the aesthetic allure of the disgusting, and the kind of aesthetic experience that we get in disgusting art. Do we really feel disgust when we confront this art, or must our disgust be denatured in some way before we can regard the object aesthetically? How can the disgusting also be attractive? What does disgust add to aesthetic experience that other emotional responses don't give us? Let's bring Carolyn Korsmeyer on the line to find out. I'm here with Carolyn Korsmeyer, professor of philosophy at the University at Buffalo, State University of New York. Hello, Carolyn.
Hello.
Hi, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Thank you for having me.
Today we're discussing your new book, Savoring Disgust, The Foul and the Fair in Aesthetics. So before we begin, maybe you want to say a word about your interest in disgust as an aesthetic experience.
Okay, well, it's been a long and indirect route. The main area of research that I've conducted in philosophy for most of my career is in the field of aesthetics and philosophy of art. And in the late 90s, I became interested in the area of aesthetics that is typically omitted from traditional theories, and that is literal taste. As you might know, modern theories of aesthetics begin as philosophies of taste, but they typically stipulate that aesthetic taste doesn't have to do with eating. In other words, eating and smelling and so forth produce sensuous pleasures, but not aesthetic pleasures. And after repeating that commonplace for a long time, I got curious about why food and drink are so traditionally omitted from the field of aesthetics and taste. In other words, why literal taste got left out of aesthetic taste. So that prompted me to write a book that was published a long time ago, 1999, called Making Sense of Taste, Food and Philosophy. And in the course of that study, I got interested in what appears to be the opposite of taste, the opposite of good taste, the opposite of taste pleasure, namely disgust. So that led me to think about disgusting foods, disgust in art, and disgust as it's exploited purposively and positively by artists in order to make a point. In other words, I'm not interested in the disgust response that leads you just to walk out of a movie or close a book or turn away from something. That's just rejection. It's not any form of appreciation. But there's lots of art that deliberately evokes some version of a disgust response in the audience. And when it does so successfully, that arousal of emotion contributes to the understanding of the meaning of the work and to the general appreciation of it. Sometimes it is even describable as a pleasure, although I don't really think it often is. It's often very disturbing. But that's my crooked path to studying disgust as an aesthetic response.
And so maybe we should start with the nature of disgust, you know, the disgust response. There are various theories of the emotions, and you canvass some of the major ones early in the book. So maybe you might tell us what you consider disgust to be, what you consider emotions, perhaps in general, to be, and how disgust is a particular case of the more general theory
of emotion.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Well, disgust figures among the so-called basic emotions that psychologists have identified. If there are such things as basic emotions, they include such things as fear, anger, surprise, joy, and disgust, and several others. It's a somewhat contentious category. And a lot of those emotions are particularly notable for the fact that they have marked physical responses and standard display characteristics in the face, in the gesture, sometimes in the bodily posture. And now, how does disgust line up with other emotions? It doesn't sound very subtle. if you just list them among the basic emotions. And one of my goals in this study was to try to draw out ways in which what at first glance appears to be a merely somatic recoil has got much more subtle varieties. Now, how does it fit in terms of general emotions? Philosophers these days are somewhat divided among themselves on where to situate the physical responses of emotions. For example, are the physical responses such as drawing back from something in fear or moving towards something in anger, are these effects of a mental event that should be identified as the emotion? Are they triggers to an emotional state? Or are they to be identified with the emotion itself? Is an emotion intrinsically a physical response? And I think the cogency of theory actually varies a bit depending on what kind of emotion one has in mind. Most philosophers, myself included, these days, favor a kind of combination position that incorporates both thoughts about intentional objects and physical conditions and responses as constituents of any given emotion. And again, that's going to vary a bit depending if one is talking about disgust or nostalgia or regret. Some of these emotions have far less of a notable sensory component. But disgust is highly sensory. In fact, most theorists believe that it requires a kind of sensory stimulus, often taste or smell, or the imagination, the imaginative description of a sensory experience. And this is something that I tend to stress in this study, because disgust, I believe, is a profoundly somatic emotion. In its extreme forms, it's manifest as nausea, sometimes actual vomiting, hopefully not in the case of aesthetic disgust, but it's possible. So for this particular emotion, I do stress the visceral aspects of it and the fact that that it's a bodily response, as well as one that is highly cognitive. In other words, that picks out important properties of the objects that it's responding to. So for this emotion, I do stress these visceral aspects, but I also would like to say that as with any emotion, they are more than merely sensations. They have intentionality. That is to say, they are directed to the particular object that typically prompts them. Another philosopher of the emotions, Peter Goldie, refers to the intentionality of physical sensations of emotions as borrowed intentionality, which is not a bad term, because often we think of intentionality as a mental phenomenon. But to give an example, if one is engaged with a narrative and something grisly happens and you find yourself mildly nauseated by it, that feeling, which is a variety of disgust, isn't just a sensation in your own insides. It's also about something. It's about the episode of the narrative that you're experiencing. So the queasy feeling, if you will, that signals disgust is about the object that is disgusting. It is very definitely meaning conveying. So in this way, being disgusted at an event, at an object, at a work of art would be distinct from, say, having the flu. If you're just sick, the queasiness you might experience is an unpleasant sensation that is about little other than itself in the state of being sick and feeling awful. But if you find disgust aroused as part of a full encounter with a work of art, then that disgust is a complex part of your response to it, and it often is a way to register something of the meaning of the work. So that's the kind of disgust, by the way, that I call aesthetic disgust, for shorthand.
Okay. One of the distinctions that you do make is between, say, metaphorical disgust, where we call something disgusting, but we're not having any somatic, queasy experience of any sort. Defend the idea that disgust, there are many varieties of disgust. The question that I would ask is, when can you tell when there, we know when we're really feeling disgust. There are certain things that are, absolutely disgusting, and there's no question about what one would feel and what emotion we are identifying when we call it disgust. But in other cases, there seem to be responses that you might want to call disgust, in which there is either no strong queasy feeling or perhaps no queasy feeling at all. And in those cases, which are more subtle, how do you know when you're feeling disgust as opposed to some other sort of emotion?
Yeah, something that where you might use the term disgusting, but it's essentially metaphorical.
Yeah. Or you don't know if it's metaphorical or it's just a more subtle case of disgust.
I think that's a really good question. And I can talk around the question, but I actually think there's a strong zone of indeterminacy there on which some important questions hinge. Although it isn't in the forefront of discussion at the moment, I think that a lot hangs on the answer, including whether so-called moral disgust really has a source in emotional response or is a profound way of expressing disapproval. And the reason I think that's an important and very difficult question is both philosophers and psychologists now seem to be open to the idea that disgust provides us with a kind of basic moral sense, that if something is disgusting, it must therefore be morally bad. And there are certainly morally weighted situations that legitimately arouse disgust, as you said before, that are absolutely clear, such as torture, that sort of thing. But there are other kinds of moral situations where it seems as though the disgust is so weighted with social value that it is actually changeable. And therefore, you would be inclined to think that the behavior that's being responded to isn't intrinsically disgusting. It's just, at the moment, not approved. This isn't an original point on my part. This is a point that Martha Nussbaum has argued extensively in her book, Hiding from Humanity, where she makes the case that as a moral emotion, disgust is highly dangerous and unreliable. But one of the reasons that I tend to avoid discussing moral disgust in the book, although I do consider certain situations where it would qualify, is that I am especially interested in the oddity of disgust as an appreciative response as opposed to condemnation. But I got to grant you that there's an area here where I think it's really indeterminate whether you have a genuine case of a basic response or a metaphorical use of a very strong negative language, because the term disgusting is strongly negative, or if you have something in between where social norms invade basic reactions and impose a kind of projection of disgust onto subjects that might not, on reflection, bear that description. What I think is impossible is simply introspecting on our feelings to make that judgment. They're just not that good grounds for evidence. So how do we distinguish? By and large, as a kind of rough and ready guide, I follow the scientific literature on the subject, which some of which talks about moral disgust, but most of which that I have read locates core or visceral disgust in objects that literally sicken or contaminate, such as decaying bodies, infected sores, that sort of thing. And the idea here, again, is that I'm following through on the idea that emotions are designed to register qualities of objects that without the emotions, we are actually blind to certain qualities and objects. And therefore, I tried to limit myself to cases where arguably the emotion was an indispensable way of grasping the meaning of something.
So let me get to one issue that directly bears on the question of, you know, what counts as real disgust as opposed to metaphorical disgust or just, you know, condemnation of some sort. And that's the question of the so-called paradox of fiction, right, where, as you put it, the puzzle of why and how things that we know aren't real prompt responses in us as if we believe them to be real. So, you know, horror movies are, of course, a paradigm example where we respond to the creature coming at us in that 3D screen as if they were really going to eat us up. But we also at the same time know that they aren't going to eat us up. And so this raises the question of, well, if we know that they're really not going to attack us, and yet it's part of what it is to be fear to believe that something really is about to attack you, then is what we're feeling really fear? Or is it, you know, quasi-fear or something else? And so the same question obviously is going to arise with cases of disgust. If a work of art is presenting to us something, you know, something that perhaps looks like viscera, but we know it's not viscera, and in the absence, say, of some strong nausea, is what we're feeling genuine disgust, or is it perhaps some sort of quasi-disgust?
Yeah. I'd like to situate that set of questions in the deep context of aesthetic theory, because the question of whether this is genuine disgust or some other genuine emotion, such as fear in horror movies, and if it is genuine, how is it that such a negative feeling becomes appreciatable? These are very complicated issues that are tangled up in the history of aesthetics. One of the chapters of this book, Savoring Disgust, addresses what was the traditional exclusion of disgust from the emotions that can be aroused by art that is beautiful or aesthetically satisfying. As you might know, in the very rich period of the 18th century, when so much aesthetic theory was being developed, disgust was unique. It was among the emotions because it's the only one that, according to a large body of theory, was completely disqualified from having positive aesthetic status. And there were a number of reasons that were advanced to justify the exclusion of disgust from good art. For one thing, it was considered to be just an unworthy emotion because the objects that trigger disgust, such as rotting corpses, are just base and low and therefore an unfit subject for art. That's a reason that we might consider to be a little antique, but it was certainly a strong one. Secondly, and this I think is a really interesting feature of this particular emotion, it was observed, and I'm speaking of theorists such as Kant or Moses Mendelssohn or Lessing, that disgust does not seem to distinguish between what is real and what is represented. So disgust alone transfers the nauseating in the natural world or in the real world to the nauseating in art with no softening of effect. I'll come back to that point in a minute. And the third reason, that disgust was omitted from good art by the lights of this theory was the idea that if something that is disgusting in nature does manage to be rendered well by an artist in a painting or in a narrative that is vividly described, then it ceases to be disgusting, but achieves the status of something like the grotesque or maybe the tragic. So in that case, the representation would skillfully mute the disgusting and transform it into something more worthy. Okay, that's the traditional view. Now, I think some of that traditional view is very insightful and some of it is a little misguided. First of all, because, as I mentioned before, I think that disgust is capable of registering viscerally some profound truths about life and death and mortality and material vulnerability, I don't want to read it out of the aesthetic menu of emotions that have positive and appreciative versions. I think that would be a loss. I also think it would be untrue to the value that we place on certain kinds of art. But interestingly enough, the point about the lack of distinction between a disgusting thing in real life and a representation of the disgusting thing, I think is pretty insightful. Because disgust does seem to be genuinely aroused by a picture or a description, just as if it were the real thing, with one important exception. It's a very important exception, and that is that most art doesn't make use of the primary disgust senses, that is to say, smell and taste. Some art does, particularly contemporary art is experimenting with this. But traditional art forms, literature, painting, and so forth, they appeal to the eye or to the imagination or to the ear in oral works rather than actually stinking. The description of the stench is enough. So that does afford us a little bit of distance, as it were. But the fact that disgusting things are rendered in a way that makes you recoil, just as it was in nature, lends disgust a power that I think can be an aesthetic advantage that this emotion particularly has. Now, you mentioned its comparison with fear, which is a very good comparison because fear and disgust very frequently come together in narrative fiction, for example. But usually, if we're at the movies or reading a book or listening to a story, we know that we're not in danger. So while our pulse may become very rapid and our blood pressure go up if we're terrified, we also know that we're not, as it were, really afraid. But in the case of disgust, it seems to me we still are really disgusted. And so being disgusted in the movie still is a brand of disgust. And so I think the tradition that singles out disgust as being rather unusual among the emotions that art can arouse, I think it's got some cogency. But I would turn it around and say that when skillfully used, often in much more subtle forms, then this is an advantage to the kind of the gut response that one gets when disgust has a role in a story.
So I think you call this the transparency of disgust.
Yes, I did.
Okay.
By that I meant that you sort of, the screen of representation is much more fragile, or it's got a lot of holes in it when it comes to art compared to, sorrow, for example, or grief, which are also very strong, terrible emotions. But if they are aroused by a fiction, you're pretty sure you can blow your nose and close the book and not be affected any further.
One of the you spend a chapter talking about food and about the transformation of foods that are disgusting to objects of delight. This sort of raises the question of whether, in some sense, the disgusting has to be transformed in some way to become an object of aesthetic experience. And if this sort of desensitization to disgusting things somehow makes it the case that in order to experience something aesthetically that is disgusting, in some sense we have to stop considering it disgusting.
Well, the case of food is a little different from other aesthetic contexts, I believe. The reason that the food chapter, incidentally, was the first one that I wrote because it's the one that most aptly followed from the earlier work on the sense of taste in food that I mentioned before. And the reason that I explored the disgusting in food is that I wanted to challenge the idea that that disgust in food simply operates as an opposite, as a negative. It either tastes good or it's disgusting. And the case I make in that particular part of the book is that there's actually a very high degree of foods that we learn to eat and that we start to consider delicious that begin in disgusting categories. That is to say, food that is a little bit rotten is something, the category of the rotten is a standard disgust elicitor. But learning to eat food, say high meat, meat that has been aged to a point where it's getting pretty stinky before it's cooked, that is a highly developed taste, a highly developed preference. And in the cases of food, I believe we do need to, I don't know if desensitization is the right term. It's more learning to expand our palates so that we come to like things that have a depth of flavor that sometimes, say, rotting something or maturing a cheese will permit. And I think, therefore, with food, you really do have a case where if the food is appreciated, and obviously not everyone is going to indulge in the same cuisines, but if a food is appreciated, it does need to be to become something that one finds flavorful and good. Although sometimes there's a hint of the revolting that remains in it. An example that I think is interesting that I myself wouldn't eat is kidneys, because kidneys supposedly should be prepared in such a way that one can still catch a whiff of the urine that they purified. So in that case, the disgust origin, namely being a bodily organ whose job it is to deal with waste, it's supposed to still be in the well-prepared kidney. So you're not really just leaving disgust behind. Rather, you're incorporating it into a depth of flavor and sometimes a depth of meaning with foods. But it, in order for it to be edible, and certainly in order for it to be enjoyed, it needs to reverse the valence from unpleasant to pleasant, or from something that you would find revolting to something that you find appealing. Does this happen with art? Well, maybe sometimes. But I think what's interesting with art, and here again, we're not dealing with things that we actually ingest, so you don't have to deal with the fact that you could poison yourself if you're not careful. When you're dealing with something that you look at or hear about or participate in, as with a participatory work of art, or read, the extremes of disgust that one can countenance are much broader, and And I think it's important that they remain disgusting, but that the response is not so much recoil as it is appreciation. And again, what basically lies behind that claim is the idea that without a disgust response, you're missing something. You're missing something about the nature of the work. To give an example, well, one of the works that I think is so interesting that I discuss in this book is a famous painting by Caravaggio called The Doubting of St. Thomas, which features the resurrected Christ, and Thomas, the apostle, is poking his fingers into the spear wound on the side in order to be sure that this is, in fact, the resurrected Christ. And when I first saw the picture, which was many years ago, I was absolutely revolted by it. I couldn't, but also fascinated by it, because I just couldn't countenance the idea of that bodily violation. But in fact, the more I thought about it, the more it seemed to me that it was a really interesting and effective use of that visceral response to convey a meaning, and a meaning about, in that case, it's got a religious meaning attached to it. But it has to do with a combination of the body and of transcendence and so forth. And I think without that basic somatic response, which remains even when one appreciates the work, or I believe should remain, the work would lose some power. And I think that there are many, many cases where the disgust response is, it's very subtle, and it mixes with many, many other responses. By itself, it's not so interesting. But when it mingles with these other responses, it adds a depth to them that is wholly positive, but it doesn't lose its visceral character.
Well, there's an interesting aspect of the use of disgust in art that you mentioned, was the fact that very often the smell and taste aspects are not included. And so there's a sense in which the use of the disgusting in art is very sharply circumscribed in a way that others not are not. And maybe that's a reflection of the fact that it is so strongly visceral. And so let me just, you know, give you an example. Cannibalism is not just sort of morally, you know, off limits, but just the very idea of eating human flesh is among the disgusting things. And yet one might think that, well, if we're going to explore the disgusting in art and in aesthetics, that cannibalism, you know, in the right artistic context, would sort of be the ultimate aesthetic experience. And yet this is not what, at least until now, you see in, for example, in performance art, where people will smear feces looking, you know, things on themselves, or use urine in particular ways, or other, you know, bodily fluids. But the idea of actually or pretending to eat human flesh is still strongly taboo. And I just wonder, is the use of the disgusting in art still very, very strongly circumscribed in ways that other emotional responses in art are not?
Well, I think that if you focus on any single emotion, you might discover that each of them has got its limits if you take it by itself. I want to come back to the example of cannibalism in a moment, but let's diverge momentarily and think about grief. Grief is a profound emotion, and it's a terrible one to experience. And it certainly is an important one that figures in a lot of works of art. But if a work of art really just aroused terrible grief, it would not be something that I think we could tolerate. So in that respect, that strong emotion would also have an aesthetic limit. But I'm not really sure it's in a limit that's terribly significant with regard to the use of emotions. Rather, it indicates that works of art are, you know, very, very fine works of art are typically very complex. And so they're going to be involving more than one emotion, and the way the emotions play off against one another, not to mention their form and design and all of the other elements that go into making something a work of art. But I think if you take any single emotion or emotion group and try and make it by itself the purpose of a work of art, you are probably going to run into some limits, including the limit of boredom sometimes. But let me get back to cannibalism. Because one does need to bear in mind that the so-called aesthetic experience, they are not always pleasant or pretty, because they can be tragic and horrid and ugly, profound, grotesque, and so forth. And disgust is usually, although it's sometimes funny, it usually figures in the more difficult works of art. And the consumption of human flesh is horrific, whether it's in a real or an artistic context, even though sometimes it's got morbidly funny aspects. But it's used in many stories to demonstrate inhumanity and cruelty in ways that I think other themes would fail to do. And in a few of those stories, it has a weirdly intimate quality. Let me just mention some of the stories that I find so interesting that I do discuss in the book. There are some tales from Boccaccio's Decameron where women are deceived into eating the heart of a lover, which is a terrible thing for them and for the reader. I mean, it's part of the story, so it's a good aspect of the story. But in terms of the action that's being portrayed, it's really quite horrific. But the impact of those tales ride on the utter taboo of eating another person. And the horror of being the instrument of destruction of a loved one is a painful, but it's also a very compelling narrative device. Another example would be the horrific scene at the final section of the movie, The Cook, the Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover, which is a scene of cannibalism, reluctant cannibalism, which is macabre and slightly funny. It's just ghastly. You could hardly bear to look at it. But it certainly contributes to the quality of the whole work. And both, I think, are good examples of the operation of aesthetic disgust, even though they are hugely different. And in the latter case, the movie, it's not very subtle. In the case of Boccaccio's stories, the queasiness that I think is prompted when one reads those stories is really quite subdued and subtle, but it also sticks with you. So does this mean the disgust is limited? It does have some limits, but I would question whether the limits are greater in scope than other strong emotions, including terror or, you know, some emotions that are very strong are rather hard to imagine, really well exploited in art, anger perhaps being one. One does feel anger in the course of certain narratives, and sometimes it has a social or political purpose. But I would submit it might have as many or even more built-in aesthetic limits compared to disgust. But one would have to explore different emotions and try and get a gauge of what would count as the scope of aesthetic exploitability. And artists are really quite deft at pushing on what we think are our limits and making them expand further than we ever thought they could.
So when an artist employs disgust inter alia among other features or other, when they have a work that, in which they seek to prompt disgust along with other emotions. What is the nature of what you call aesthetic disgust? Not just disgust caused by a work of art, but the particular kind of aesthetic experience that disgust prompts.
I'm not sure I would want to generalize about that because works of art differ so much. And in certain cases, the arousal of disgust might be comic, in which case it would have a certain kind of valence that's more amusing than horrid. In other cases, it might be very fearful, and that would give it a tinge of a different sort. In the Boccaccio stories, as I say, there's a very poignant intimacy to the discovery that one has eaten the heart of a lover. What I think is perhaps common among those different aesthetic qualities, although I want to be cautious about this because I think each particular work has an aspect of uniqueness that one shouldn't try to overgeneralize about. But what is often common to the arousal of disgust is that it does give you a kind of intimacy with the work. By intimacy, I mean you feel it viscerally. Even although when it's funny, you might not experience that quite so closely as it is when it's sorrowful, or when it brings elements of mortality to mind. Because I think that the common denominator that I particularly value myself in art that arouses disgust in its more subtle forms especially is a value that it's a way to grasp something that we know about all the time, but that's extremely hard really to wrap your mind around, and that is mortality. Oh, we know we're mortal, but we don't, it's not a very pleasant thought, but it's also very hard really to grasp. And I think that disgust in skillful hands is a means by which we sort of come face to face with that. And perhaps that would be an indispensable role that aesthetic disgust can play with certain works of art. But I should emphasize, I don't want to say it's always playing that role. And sometimes it's just exploited for its own effect.
Well, I mean, the disgusting, as you point out, is quite often associated with decay, not just, you know, death as such, but the decay of flesh, the, you know, that maggots and worms and, you know, flesh and wounds and smells and, you know, other sorts of bodily liquids and things of that nature. So calling our attention in a work of art to those particular aspects of mortality, could you explain a bit more about how that becomes part of aesthetic experiences of art?
Because it can be part of the meaning of the work. I take a view that an important thing about the nature of an aesthetic response is that it's a kind of cognition. It's a kind of cognition that you get by various means, sensory, imaginative, and emotional. And I call it cognitive because I think that's what gives art its a particular force and its particular meaning. It's what gives the aesthetic its importance. It's more than just looking a particular way or sounding a particular way. And emotions, when they're aroused by art, are major contributors to that aesthetic cognition.
So you also coin a term, the sublate, and draw a parallel between that that sort of response and what is called the sublime. I was wondering if you could perhaps tell us a bit about what you mean by that particular aesthetic concept.
Yes, the concept of the sublime, which of course is quite familiar, is an idea of a powerful aesthetic emotion that has a foundation that is related to another deeply unpleasant emotion, namely terror. And with the sublime, however, the terror is actually transmuted or transmogrified or converted in some way to a positive experience that may still have some roots in fear or terror, but it becomes a kind of transcendent experience of the powerful, the magnificent, maybe the divine. And with the sublate, I tried to tease out a parallel with disgust as the foundation. And with this term sublate, I was trying to get with a general term at the ability of certain experiences of disgust, by no means all, but certain experiences of disgust, to transform this emotion into a kind of, what we might consider a kind of existential insight about mortality and material decay. It isn't nearly as elevated as the sublime. In fact, you could say it's sort of the reverse direction. But it can carry with it a sort of resignation and acceptance and acknowledgement of mortality. Just as the sublime delivers immediate impact and becomes its own emotion, the idea of the sublate is a similarly immediate and visceral grasp of mortality, bodily vulnerability, and so forth. At that point, we may not be inclined to call it disgust, just as we're not inclined to call the sublime fear. But we recognize the traces of the foundational emotion in the experience.
So is the sublate a sort of a standalone kind of experience, or is it one that necessarily or typically is one that accompanies other sorts of aesthetic experiences? So, for example, if you have a horror movie and you add to it some disgusting, you know, scenes, you may enhance or deepen the aesthetic experience by adding the disgusting aspects. But just pure disgust on its own might not have any kind of, you know, deep aesthetic experience at all. And similarly with comedy, you may have some sort of a comic situation, and then you add to it maybe some disgusting aspect in order to, you know, make it funny or change the tenor of the joke. And so is the disgusting or the sublate, is this the sort of thing that you might aim for on its own? Or is it always something that is sort of enhancing other sorts of aesthetic responses?
Well, I think that as a rule, one doesn't tend to experience emotions singly, especially in complicated works of art, because they usually come bundled up with either companion emotions such as disgust and fear, or in the case of comedy, disgust and amusement, or disgust and just rejection and disapproval. So I would say in most cases you probably do have a combination of effect of affects as well as of effects. The same is probably true with the sublime. It's more than just horror. It also has to do with recognition of the nature of the object that is prompting the horror, the terror. So I'm not sure if you're wondering if what I'm saying about if disgust is more apt than other emotions to need deeper context with other emotions or not. I'm not sure. Again, I think it would depend on the particular work of art one has in mind. There are certain works of art that appear only to desire to disgust. And my own view is they're not terribly interesting. Stephen King has the expression, the gross out, which is, in his own words, the sort of desperation move he makes when he can't manage to horrify or terrify. And there is some art that is just perhaps aimed at a gross out. And maybe it's and by the way, I think television and movies do that marvelously with special effects. And if it becomes its own end, I think it's pretty limited. But at that point, I don't think we're dealing with the profundity that disgust achieves when it's when it appears as part of a more complicated response and appreciation.
Okay, I think we're close to running out of time. Let me just explore the relationship between aesthetic disgust and beauty, right? I mean, aesthetic judgment has been historically connected with judgments of beauty, and yet the disgusting, of course, is often thought to be antithetical to the nature of beauty. So I wonder if you could say a bit about how you see the relationship between disgust and beauty, and also pleasure as well.
Well, that is one of the most difficult questions that I try to address in the book. With most of the kinds of art that I have in mind, I'm not sure that beauty and disgust necessarily are part of the same discussion, because art is more than beautiful. It can be, strenuous, taxing, tragic, and sometimes it's also beautiful. I do try to make a case that with certain kinds of art, the disgust contributes to beauty. But at that point, I'm probing the edges of aesthetic disgust. And I think much of the time the disgust actually halts the kind of positive response that we are inclined to call beautiful. There are some maybe exceptions. An exception that I like to think about is some of Emily Dickinson's poetry. There's a famous poem of hers that I can't quote completely from memory, but it begins with the phrase, the line, "I heard a fly buzz when I died." And the poem goes on in her very economical language to take the point of view of a person who is awaiting burial, who's confronting a carrion fly that will soon, with its many companions, make short work of the body. Which, if you think about it, is a hugely disturbing and disgusting image, but it's such an economically tight and vivid poem that I think it's also a pretty good candidate for both what I venture to call this oblate and for also being beautiful. But I do think that when you come to beauty, we're talking about what some theorists call difficult beauty, not by any means that which is merely pretty or attractive or charming, but something that really taxes the audience. And sometimes I think it still remains within the zone of the beautiful. Other times it may depart from it and just be too tragic or grotesque to be still considered beautiful. But that doesn't mean that it loses its positive aesthetic character, because beauty, unless one expands it hugely, only encompasses a certain range of aesthetically positive qualities, a very important range. And I do try to push disgust into that range in the final speculations of the book.
Okay. And I guess, finally, maybe we have another minute. What particular works of art do you consider sort of paradigmatic of the sorts of aesthetic experiences provided by disgust?
Well, I don't know that I want to choose a paradigm, because I think that there are so many different varieties of aesthetic disgust, which, come to think of it, is the title of a chapter, that it would be hard to single out paradigms among them. But if we want to think of visual works, both filmic and still paintings or drawings, images of perhaps violated bodies would be an example. Now, they can be just horrific, but sometimes they're done in a way that's very compelling and moving. In the case of narratives, I find myself especially moved by the descriptions of war narratives, of, again, the terrible atrocities that can occur in war, not necessarily through cruelty, but just through the awful things that occur in the course of wars. These are kinds of narratives where I think unless we confront the visceral power of those images, we lose something with regard to the meanings of the works. So those would be perhaps strong examples, if not complete paradigms. There are certain tragedies, including the classic Greek tragedies, where highly disgusting images are part of the famous aspects of the narrative, such as Oedipus blinding himself and other kinds of mutilations in tragedies. These are indispensable parts of the narratives, I believe, and therefore aspects of aesthetic disgust that we would not want to do away with. They're difficult to encounter. We might find ourselves flinching and recoiling in that respect, but we wouldn't want to excise them from the works, I don't think, because the works would suffer as a result. They would become less meaningful, less deep, less profound, and less, in some ways, valuable.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your time. I've been talking with Carolyn Korsmeyer, professor of philosophy at the University at Buffalo, State University of New York, about her new book, Savoring Disgust, The Foul and the Fair in Aesthetics, just out from Oxford University Press. This is New Books in Philosophy. I'm Carrie Figdor. I hope you enjoyed our podcast, and thank you for listening.